Hello and welcome to the Martial Arts Teaching Tactics Podcast. I'm Chris Kent and I'm joining Chris Bean. Mr. Bean?
Hello, sir.
Today we're going to be talking about teaching big classes. Now, teaching a big class can be a make or break moment for you and your team. Mr. Bean, what would you say is an ideal ratio of team members to students in your classes?
Yeah, so this would actually differ depending on the age of the students. If you're working with 3 and 4 year olds, you want a 1-to-4 ratio. If you have 5 through 7 year olds, you want a 1-to-5 ratio. If you have 7 through 12 year olds, you want a 1-through-10 ratio. And if you have 13 and up, you have a 1-to-15 ratio. Of course, these are all guidelines depending on the aptitude of the student. They could be more or less depending, but that's a good baseline from where you want to be. If you're working with the real little guys, the 3 and 4 year olds, you don't want any more than 4 students in a group per one instructor. You know, after that, 4 starts to get out of hand a little bit.
And in those ratios, those numbers are, the first number is the staff and the second number is the student, correct?
So yes. You want
1 staff member for every 4 kids or 1 staff member for 5 kids, 1 per 10 and so on and so forth, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah, and you know, as the students progress through your program, maybe you can handle, or they can handle a little bit more students in a given class. Or if it's a one off, meaning you're short staffed on that one day, and you have to put 2 extra kids in that age group in that group together, I'm sure that would be fine. But again, these are just the guidelines that we like to try to keep.
Right. And as you said, it does depend on what you're doing for that day. You know, some drills and exercises, activities or training days don't require so many people to be on the floor, but it's a good benchmark, a good goal to have if you want to be able to manage your floor well and manage the students well and give them the proper attention that they deserve.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you find yourself continually teaching a big class or that you're understaffed, then it may be time to restructure your program to better aid your students. And if you are understaffed or whatever the situation is and you are teaching a big class or at least a bigger class than you think you should be teaching, step number one is don't let the students know that you're overwhelmed. Keep your cool. Be confident. Prioritize the most important information. When you're working with large groups, you want to make sure that you cover the most important information. Maybe you do that first just to make sure that is covered, and then you have time perhaps later to get to the extra credit type information. Covering the most important information for the day is key to keeping your students on track and ready for their belt test.
Yeah, you mentioned keeping your cool and not letting the class know that you're overwhelmed. I think we might have touched on this before in previous episodes, but faking it till you make it and playing that part of the good instructor or the balanced instructor and the well-prepared instructor and the well-prepared instructor, if you start to freak out, you start to lose your composure, they're all going to pick up on that and they're all going to feed off the energy, and it's going to be even harder for them. You know, what's the saying is during a crisis, you want to stay calm, and you know, there's a big fire, you know, everyone going crazy, trying to run out the door. You want to stay calm and orderly and make your way out. And you don't want that chaos or that panic to break out and infect everybody. So if you're in a big class and it happens to be you or you're understaffed, you all need to keep your cool and just pretend like it's another day. This is what you do. And then here we go. We're going to teach this class. Not a big deal at all. Even if on the inside you're freaking out and you're worried about being able to service everybody and how you're going to manage everything at once. But again, you set the tone for that class. So when you are calm, more likely than not, they're going to be calm too, and your energies are going to feed off of each other. So keeping your cool in all situations is very important, but especially if you feel overwhelmed or in those times when you don't know what's going to happen next or you're really uncertain of yourself or how the class is going to go, being calm and keeping your cool is going to go a long way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, if you are kind of freaking out on the inside and the outside, it's very easy, like you said, for the students to pick up on that. And likely if that happens, you're going to be teaching a bad class or going down a crazy path because you're crazy on the inside and you're letting that crazy spill over to the outside. So whatever you're feeling on the inside, keep the cool, calm, collected outside so that the students don't key in on that.
As much as we need to be thinking ahead as well, it's important to focus on the present. So if you're in that class and you're running the warm-up at the very beginning of the class, focus on what you're doing during that warm-up and be present during that warm-up. Don't be thinking about when the warm-up's over, how you're going to arrange the class or how you're going to work on the drills and how you're going to get everyone to make sure they're involved. Yes, we need to have a plan for that. We need to be ready for that to happen, but we can't be consumed by those forward-thinking thoughts and the anxiety that comes with that and not knowing what to do or not be feeling like you are prepared. So have the plan, be able to set that plan into motion and follow that process, but don't let that worry you or don't let that take away from what you're doing presently or currently as you are freaking out or losing your cool. Focus on what you're doing. Move on to the next thing, take it step by step, and then eventually after you complete all those steps, class is over, pat yourself on the back, move on, do the next one.
Yeah, and you know, we'll go through a few different scenarios or a few different tools that we'll give you to tackle a large class size. And so the first one is keeping the class in a large group is one option to this situation. Okay, providing you have enough room to move, you can lead everybody all at one time. This may mean that some of your students are doing moves that are above their requirements, and some students are doing moves that are below their requirements. That's okay as long as you keep everybody moving and at least getting some reps on their current information.
Having lower belts do higher belt material isn't a problem. I mean, first of all, odds are you do that once in one class and they won't have to know it for another year and a half. In a year and a half, they might not remember it, or in a year and a half, they will have a vague idea of what they did, but you're not focused on them doing the technique correctly per se. You don't want them to do it completely wrong. Like, you want to make sure they're somewhere in the ballpark, but your focus doesn't have to be on them doing it correctly because they don't need to know it yet. So there's definitely no harm in them doing advanced moves if it's capable. Of course, if it's a tough move that we need to be really sure they know what they're doing correctly, and that way they don't hurt themselves or hurt other people, we want to be more careful about that. But having them run through some hand techniques or foot techniques that they don't necessarily need to know, again, you don't have to focus on that being correct. You can just have them do that and run through that while the upper belts get the repetition and the practice that they need doing those moves, that they need to know those moves. And hopefully at that point, either they know what's going on or you're able to kind of not tune out the other students, the lower students, still pay attention to them, but focus more on the students that need to know that material as well. And, you know, vice versa, if you are a higher belt and you are practicing some of your older techniques, you should be doing that anyways. You should be going over that older material and practicing that older material. So if you have a lower belt that's learning something, the upper belt, the higher belt, can definitely be there listening to what you're saying, maybe picking up something different than they did last time, or maybe you as a teacher have evolved and you are teaching something differently, or you're covering more points or giving more tips that student didn't get the first time that you taught that move. So it's definitely beneficial for the upper belts to be working on that lower stuff as well. So there's nothing wrong with keeping everyone together and having everyone do the same thing, even if it's not required for them, or it was not required for them for a while. Having them all together, going through that material is not a problem at all.
Yeah, you know, if you have this type of situation and you have the higher belts reviewing or relearning some information, I think a way that you can set that up so it isn't boring for them is tell them that, hey, I want you to utilize this time to reevaluate your movement. Make sure that you are still doing it the way that you need to do it. So as I'm explaining this to the lower belts, check in with yourself and make sure that you are on track and still doing those moves the way that I'm explaining it. So that way they're not thinking, oh man, I got to learn this again. We've already done this. That way it takes it from a boring type situation and keeps them engaged and just shifts their mindset just enough that makes it so they are getting something out of that class like they should be.
I like to emphasize the team aspect of it as well. So if we have a lot of different belt groups, or even someone as a white belt that started a month ago and they've done this stuff already a few times, and I have new white belts in class, I'll say, okay, even if you already know how to do that, this is great, but I want you to do this with us as a team. We're going to work on it together. Maybe we do it a few times slow as a team, and then I'll tell those people, hey, if you already know this, go ahead and do it by yourself. I'm going to walk the other people through this because it's new for them. While we're walking through it, you can practice on your own and have that self-practice time. But that reinforces the movement. And then again, I like it. I like us to feel like a team. I like us to feel like a cohesive unit and working together. And again, that's maybe another way to make it feel less boring and to shift their mindset of, oh, I don't have to relearn this again. I already know this, but I'm going to go slow to help out everyone else who this stuff is brand new to. And as we're talking, I'm thinking about the opposite of that situation in which we have lower students, lower belt students and upper belt students together. We need to work on the upper belt material, but we don't necessarily want the lower belts to do those things. At that time, it's totally fine if I say, hey, lower belts, I want you to work on this move as we are doing this move. So the upper belts are going to do move number 7. As they do move number seven, I want you to do number 1. I know it's going to be different, but you do number 1, they do number 7. Okay, go. All right, next one. They're going to do move number 8, but you do move number 2. So while we do this, you do that. So you can go both ways about it. They can do it with them and see that advanced or that technique that's going to be farther along for them, or you can emphasize their current techniques, the ones they need to know while everyone else is moving forward and doing the next level that they need to be at as well.
Absolutely. You know, another solution to this issue would be to separate your class into groups by belt or skill level. With this method, you have each group start reviewing information as you move around from group to group. And when you do that, you give them just a little bit of new information or tweak some of their older information. Then you move to the next group. With this, again, you need to make sure that you're able to visit every group that you have. So depending on how many groups you have in your class, you need to manage your time correctly so that you can visit each and every one of those groups and have time to have impact or have time to give information to all of those groups. You don't want to miss any because you ran out of time. So manage your time appropriately for that. When you do this, you may need to only give each group a move or two so that you are able to continue moving and making it to every group as well. I think a key part of this is how you arrange or separate your groups. Keeping the same belt groups or skill groups together, depending on how you break down or teach your information, means that you are not going to be teaching the same information several times as you visit different groups. So if you have white belts, yellow belts, and orange belts in a class, and you separate them by, okay, I want all the white belts on this team over here, yellow belts, you're on this team, and the orange belts, you're on this team over here. You separate them out, then you go visit the white belts, you give them one or two moves or feedback on what they're doing, then you move to the next group. And the yellow belts are doing different moves than the white belts, so you teach their brand new move or whatever it is once or twice and let them get eyes on it. Okay, yep, you guys are good, practice that, I'll be back, and then you go to the orange belts and so on. What this does is, causes you to not reteach the same information every handful of minutes. So if I had, you know, okay, I want 5 people here, 5 people here, 5 people here, 5 people here, and then they disperse in that, in those categories, but the belt ranks are mixed. Okay, that means I go to group 1 and I teach white belts this, I teach yellow belts this, I teach orange belts this. Then I go to the next group and I do the same thing. And I go to the next group and do, that's not efficient use of your time. So dividing them up by skill level or belt level, depending on how you teach or break down your information, so that when you visit one group, you teach move 1 and 2. When you visit the next group, you teach move 3 and 4. You visit the next group, you teach move 6 and 7. That'll make it a very wise use of your time as you're dividing those up.
This is something that you introduced to me. I learned doing this from you and having the different groups, different sections, and if you have an available staff member, assigning them to 1 or 2 of those groups to watch over that. So you go around to each group and you teach the new techniques and they're sitting there and they get to see and overlook as everyone's practicing. And that's ideal. That's the best case scenario. But if it's just you, you can still do the same thing. Have the 4 different groups, go to each one at a time. And I love to do this with higher belt levels because it not only gives me the opportunity to look at them and work with them myself and know what's being taught to them. But then as I go to each group and have that one-on-one with each group, the groups that I'm not working with have their self-practice time. They can sit there and they can work on the moves and practice what we just went over. And then I can come back and check on it. And that's like a real time check-in with them to say, hey, no, do it this way. Or, hey, that's really good. Great job doing that. Keep that up. So we don't have to wait for them to go home and practice and then come back and be like, oh, well, actually you need to do this. Because we impart the information, we walk away for a little bit as they're practicing. When we come back, we do that check-in on the information to make sure it's how we want it to be and be able to move on from there. I don't normally do this with lower belts. very rarely will I put a few groups of white belts separately and spend time on each one. Sometimes you have to, like in big classes, that's your only option, is to, you know, do that and divide the class up that way. I don't normally do it with lower belts. I'll keep it more to the upper belts. I think because as you're beginning, there's a lot more question, a lot more uncertainty. And as we talked about earlier, the farther along you are in your training, the more that you've done class and the more you've been around, you kind of become more confident, more certain of those things, or more aware of how you are learning and how to take correction and praise and criticism, all to make you even better at what you're doing. So not that you can't do with lower belts, but that's something I try to very rarely use at a lower level, and more typically use it more often at a higher level. And the higher you go, the easier it is to kind of let them not do their own thing, but I feel more comfortable letting them practice on their own and delivering the information that way. So again, sometimes it's necessary, sometimes you have to, but that's not something I always use at lower levels, and typically more at a higher level.
Yeah. And you know, when you have these different belt groups situated on your floor, I would advise choosing somebody in the group to lead the group. So that person is sort of in charge of saying, okay, let's start now. Okay, everybody's doing it. Okay, great. Now we'll stop. And then that person says, okay, let's start again. And so that really that person's job is to hit start and stop for the team. But telling them, or giving that person, or giving somebody on that team that responsibility, will help make it so that your groups are running smoothly. Because if that doesn't happen, if you don't tell them, hey, John is in charge of you guys, he's going to say go, you guys all do it together, he'll say stop, check in, make sure everybody's on the same page, he says go again, and so on. One, that gives John the sense of ownership over that group, at least to a certain extent. He has a good feeling about it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the person that is best in the group that has that. You might just say, okay, you're going to do it, you're going to do it, and you're going to do it, just because those are the first three people that you see, or you know their names or whatever it is. But just doing that will make your group so much more efficient, because that means that there's less confusion about what's going on. Who's going to say go? Who's going to say stop? You just, this person says go and this person says stop. Okay, do it. This person says go, this person says stop. Okay, go do it. And so if you have done this in the past and it hasn't worked out very well for you, try again with just that key change, right? Giving somebody the responsibility to say, okay, let's start. Okay, let's stop. Okay, check and make sure. Okay, everybody, all right, everybody's good. All right, good, let's do it again. Okay, as they go through, okay, stop. And then just put one person kind of in charge of that. And then as the groups progress, or as the team progresses through the ranks, maybe that person in charge gets to shift. And so the first time it's this person, and then the next time that person says start and stop, and then they do it, and then the next time it's somebody else, and then they go through, and then the next time it's somebody else. And so shifting that responsibility, that role of saying start and stop within the team, or within the team itself, helps to divide that respect and that ownership, not just from one person, but from everybody in the team. And so again, just if you've done it before and it hasn't worked out for you, try it with that key change. I think that really, I think that will make a difference.
And as you begin to learn more about your students and know your students, you're able to determine their personalities and how well they will fit into that role. And what I mean by that is, maybe you have someone who has a big ego, someone who is overly confident, or thinks that they are the best, or thinks they know everything. You might want to shy away from putting them in charge, or you want to make sure that the responsibility is quickly changing, so that person isn't always in charge. Because the last thing you want to do is you want to feed into that ego and feed into the overconfidence and feed into that, give them power that they might abuse. And it's unfortunate to have to say that, but we want to be able to instill or reinforce the idea of humility as well, because I think that's an important part of martial arts, an important part of being a human. To reinforce that humility. So again, as you start to know your students, you know their personalities, and maybe you'll have someone who's really shy, and same thing. I don't want to put you out of your comfort zone too much. I might have you lead the group, as we said, in a rotation. You do it one time and then you get to go to the back or whatever, and that gives you a little boost of confidence, but you're not stuck in charge of that group the whole time, because what probably will happen is you won't want to do it, or you won't know what to do, and someone else will end up taking over. And then there's that power struggle because really you were put in charge. And I come back to the group and I say, oh, well, why isn't Jane in charge? I put Jane in charge. And you're like, oh, well, she didn't want to do it. So I stepped up. Just knowing your students and knowing what's going to help them. And like you said, you don't always want to put the best student in charge. Maybe you want someone else. So you have another guy over here. You got Tyler over here, and Tyler's not very confident. But he does okay with his stuff. Like, he's a pretty good student. He just doesn't have that. He has that low self-esteem, that low confidence. And maybe putting him in charge can be an extra boost to that confidence or make him feel more confident what he's doing. So not only is it a good tool to help organize your class or deal with those big settings of students, but it can also do a lot for their motivation and their the way they're feeling, or that confidence and working on those things and developing those character skills in different ways as well.
Absolutely.
And I think in some of these cases, when you're making groups, if you have lower belt levels and higher belt levels, making one of the leaders a higher belt. So you have your white belts, your yellow belts, your orange belts, and you make some groups of white belts and some groups of yellow belts, and you have a handful of orange belts. Taking those higher belts and putting them in charge of the lower belts, assigning that senior belt level with a junior belt level, I think does the same job as diminishing your need to be everywhere. But then you're also developing that relationship between the two different belt levels. So if I'm always working with white belts, I'm going to probably hopefully have a good relationship with white belts, but I don't necessarily always see yellow belts or orange belts. But putting them in the group with them, that's going to hopefully strengthen that relationship. And then that senior belt level also is able to see a different perspective or different side of their technique. So as we've already discussed, teaching something is way different than doing something. And so if they have that opportunity to be in charge of that group and not per se teach them, but oversee them and look for mistakes and try to help the students become better, that offers them that different perspective, that new perspective of what's happening. And hopefully that will improve their efficiency, improve the way they're doing their moves, because they're able to see not just the one side of performing the technique, but also everything else that goes into teaching and understanding and improving their techniques too. So if you have the opportunity to put senior belts in charge of junior belts, I think it can be beneficial for you to help spread your presence across the class, so to speak, because you have those belts there acting on your behalf. But then it improves the higher belt by seeing different angle, and the lower belt gets the opportunity to practice. Just like I talked about before, though, you have to be careful, because you don't want that hot-headed, egotistical orange belt in charge of the white belt. You're literally just handing them power that you know they're going to abuse. So if you can, just remind them to be humble, remind them that they're not here to point fingers or beat people down, but they're just here to watch. Like, I just want you to look at them, just watch what they're doing. If they, help them if they need help, but you're not here to lord your knowledge over them. You're just here to help them and not really be in charge of them. So knowing your students is important in this situation as well.
Yeah. And that kind of talks about a little bit of the junior team member program. And we might go a little bit further in depth into that a little bit later in other episodes. But basically, you have a selection of upper students that you've handpicked to be helpers, to be junior team members, to come and help you with the lower belt ranks. And the great thing about this is they get to learn some leadership skills. It gets to further their training, because in order to teach, they have to really know how to do it. Or even if they're just assisting, if they're just saying, hey, good job, good job, good job, if they're just a good job type person, that is still going to be beneficial for you, the instructor on the floor, because that frees you up to move to another group and continue to keep moving. So having a junior team member program is definitely helpful, especially when you're teaching really large classes, or if you have a huge influx in students and you don't quite have the staff ready there, having junior team members is a good key for that. And again, we'll go a little bit further into depth in that a little bit further future episode.
Yes, sir. Yeah. One thing I like to do as well for big classes, and this is something I typically reserve for the younger classes or the beginners classes, not so much at the higher level. So almost the opposite of, as we were talking about breaking your class up into groups, for the younger ages and specific types of line drills, specific drills that we can use this for, don't be afraid to get the parents and the family involved, especially if you're still trying to sell them on your program or you're still trying to get them to see the benefits of the program and get them to believe in what you're doing. You know, run a line drill, have a couple of students in a line, bring a parent in and say, hey, I need you to hold this pad, or I need you to do this self-defense move, like do this attack to them so they can practice their self-defense. Or maybe it's just counting kicks as they're practicing their balance, whatever it may be. Get the parent or that family member on the mat, on the floor, involved in what's happening, and be sure to let them know exactly what's going to happen and what you expect from them. So if I need the student to do four punches, I need the parent or the family member to hold a pad a certain way. I go to each parent as I'm describing the exercise, as I'm describing the drill, and I do it with them, and I hold their hand where it needs to be so they get to feel and get to know what's going to happen. That way, when I say go, they're not completely lost. They've had the chance to experience exactly what I want from them, and they get to know exactly what's about to happen. And then after you lay all the groundwork, let everyone know what's going on, you get the class started, let them know that they can have fun with it. I want them to have fun with it. It doesn't need to be a, hey, your hand was not quite in the right position. I want you to have a good time and enjoy it, because being able to share this experience with your kid or your family member, I think, is very special. It's not something that we get to do every single class. And again, it's not something that is appropriate for everything. Certain line drills or certain exercises are more equipped to this, but if you can get the parent on the floor and get them to be part of it, I think it's beneficial for everybody. And just make sure that if you do this, you want to put the parent or the family member with their kid / family member. So if I'm in the class and my son is in this class, I want my son in my line. I want to be able to have the chance to do the martial arts with my son. I don't want him four lines ahead of me over there, so I'm holding pads and trying to look over and see what he's doing over there and not get the chance to interact with him. So when you do this or when you use this, make sure they know exactly what's going to happen, what you expect from them. Let them know to have fun, and then make sure that they have a chance to do that with their child or with their family member, to, again, kind of strengthen that bond and bring both people in on the training and to help you a little bit. That way you don't have to be running seven lines at once. You can have some people there assisting you, and then you're able to overview everything and then step in when you need to, correct things you need to, or to help those parents in that situation.
Yeah, and from time to time, as you do that, perhaps let those parents know, hey, we have these pads for sale, and that can be an opportunity for you to have that extra revenue, because then they can practice those moves that they did in class, because they already know now how to hold the pads. You can sell them those pads so they can practice those moves at home. That's going to help them grow as their connection as a family, but also, obviously get a little bit of revenue from those pads, and have, you know, that student make sure that they're practicing at home, and then their parents on board, with the practice, with the moves, and they're on the class, they're holding the pads. That's a great time to have that extra pads or whatever the material that you're using for that class for sale. And then let those parents know that.
Talking about perspective shifts as well. Maybe you have that parent or that family member who's been thinking about joining the martial arts or thinking about being there with their student, and you never know. Getting them on the floor and doing that one drill might be the thing that pushes them over the edge and allows them or convinces them to join and sign up. And speaking about revenue, there's a whole new student for you. There's another source of income, but then also it helps to make the martial arts more of a inclusive or family type thing. When you have dad training with son, or mom and daughter, or vice versa, whatever it is, they're able to do that together. And, you know, some of these people, they put their kid into the program, and then they show up for every class, 45 minutes, an hour long, twice a week, however long it is. And again, another way could just look at them and say, hey, you're here already. Why don't you just get in class with them? Like, it's going to benefit you health-wise, fitness-wise, but then you get to do class with your son or your daughter, your child, and you also get to reap the benefits of the program yourself. I mean, you sit here for 45 minutes anyways. Why don't you go out there and be active and have that experience with your child and develop those memories and be able to make that a family thing and not just you watching them and them doing it. Again, that's not for everybody, I understand, but you never know. That might be the extra push they need to help join the program and to help everyone involved in that situation.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes as the parents watching, they see it from one side. You know, they see it from the parent side. They don't get to see what it's like to be on the floor. And so just that one touch of being on the floor might be enough to push them in. Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. I think another way to help us manage large classes, it would be dividing the class up and then taking turns. Again, this is situational. This isn't applied to every drill or exercise. And also you want to be careful with this because one of the main things you want to do is minimize downtime. So if I can avoid you standing around doing nothing, then I want to be able to do that. That way you're constantly moving or constantly training or constantly practicing. So with this next one, again, you want to make sure it's the appropriate time, the appropriate length of time, and make sure that everyone is getting a good class and getting good movement. But what we can do is we can divide the class up maybe in three or four groups, and then we can have them exercise their discipline by holding their time position or waiting while one of those three groups is performing. So for example, I have three groups. I put two of the groups on the side of the room holding their time position. I put one group in the middle of the room. They do their form. They do their set of moves. Okay, now group one, you switch with group two. Group two does their moves while group one and the other group are standing there. And then group two switches with group three, and then they do their moves while everyone's standing there. So again, you want to be careful with what you do this or how, when you use this, and also how long. Because if they're standing there for 10 minutes, that's way too much time. You just wasted 10 minutes of their class time and 10 minutes of their practice time that you could have used differently. But if it's a short drill, you can do quickly. And especially, I think this is important or helpful for testing. If I'm going to test someone on their techniques or moves, not that it's impossible, but it's hard to watch 30 people at once. But if I can break it down and watch 10 people at once, it makes it a whole lot easier. So again, make sure it's the appropriate amount of time and the appropriate thing that you're using it for, but we can definitely take turns. And as I said, kind of preface what you want them to do on the side, whether it be sitting or holding their time position or holding their relaxed position, whatever it is, let them know that, hey, even though you're not performing, I still have my eyes on you. I want you to exercise your discipline and your focus and your respect and hold your position, control your body, and be mindful of what's happening. You could even sit there and watch the people who are actually doing it, because chances are they might screw up, and then I'll help them. And then you know, okay, don't do this. Like, you can learn from other people's mistakes as you're just standing there. So this is another useful tool. But again, something we want to use in appropriate times for the appropriate length, and not always for every single thing. But it does have benefits for you and for them as well.
Yeah, and you know, another way to do this, and again, you have to be careful because this would make it go a little bit longer. But as you have those different teams going through their information, you have another team that's watching one person. So if I'm on team two while team one is doing their moves, team two is watching the first person, and the second person is watching the second. So I'm assigned, you assign them each an individual person.
Like a Civil War lineup sitting across from each other.
Yeah, I'm watching this person. My next person is watching this one, and so on down the line. And when they're done, I have to give that person feedback on how they did. And the way to set this up for success is, as my feedback has to be two positive things with one corrective implementation, or one corrective feedback.
Sounds to me like praise, correct praise.
Yes. I give them one thing. Hey, you did a good job on this. And then I say, okay, if you did this a little bit better, it would be even greater. And then I say, you did this phenomenal though. And then we move to the next person. Hey, you did this. And that goes to the next person in line, and so on and so on. Again, that makes it last a little bit longer, but that helps keep the people who are not necessarily doing the moves engaged and focused on what's going on, because they know that you're going to call on them. Okay, hey, John, how'd Sally do? Oh, I forgot to watch. Okay, then you give feedback on Sally because you were watching, you were paying attention. And then you go to Joe. Okay, hey, Joe, how did Samantha do? Oh, Samantha did great on this. She could do this a little bit better. And, you know, she did this excellent. And then, and so on down the line. And that's a great way to help keep everybody involved and their minds actually in and focused on what's going on.
I would take it a step further too and hold them accountable. You know, so, you know, you go to the kid and say, oh, I didn't watch. It's like, okay, well, either you're going to have to make something up, or we're going to do it again and you're going to pay attention, because I don't want them to have that easy way out of, oh, I don't know, or everything they did was great. first of all, we're not all great. There's something we all can improve upon, something we all can do differently. And so again, holding them accountable and saying, hey, if you don't have an option for this, like, well, that's not an option. You need to be paying attention and you know what's going on. And I will not accept, oh, it was perfect, it was great, because that's not going to benefit anybody. If you can't give them at least something to work on, then again, that's going to feed into their ego and make them maybe have a self-inflated or a overly inflated view of themselves, or they're just going to, you know, go home with nothing to strive to be better. And so holding them accountable to actually delivering two of those positives and maybe one negative is very important as well too, because we don't want them to just be spacing out and not paying attention as they are performing those techniques.
And when you're teaching large groups, understand that you likely will not get through everything that you had planned for that class, because the class is larger than it normally was, or you have less staff than you should have or normally do have. That's okay, as long as you have a plan moving forward. Take note of the information that you were able to get through. That way, the next class, if it's your staff is back or there's less people there, or you've had time to come back and think about some creative solutions, then you're able to pick up right where you left off. So again, going into the class thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to get through everything for the, nope, you will not, that won't happen. It won't happen, because as humans, we vastly overestimate the amount of time that it takes to get something done. Meaning, I think this is going to take 5 minutes and actually it's going to take 35 minutes. That's just, as humans, that's something we don't do very well at. And so as you're trying to plan for that class, if you think, yep, I'm going to get through everything I can get through, despite there being 15 more people and me being, you know, the only person on the floor, that's not going to happen. So understand that going into it. Have a plan. Know where you left off. That way, for the next class, you're able to pick up right where you left off. Quick review, pick up right where you left off and continue moving forward.
In those cases, and in normal classes, I think as well, don't be afraid to assign them homework. You know, just like they would in school, giving them homework is a great way to, at the very least, let our students know that we expect them to spend time outside of class working on their techniques. And they should be spending time outside of class working on their techniques. And when you're given these homework assignments, make sure it's very detailed. So I don't mean, hey, go home and practice your form. Go home and practice your hand techniques. Like, oh, like, go home, I want you to work on these specific things. Or go home and focus on this specific aspect of your form. That way they have that specific thing to focus in on, because rather than just a general homework assignment of, oh yeah, do your form. Okay, I do my form one time. Technically, I did my form. I did my homework. But saying, okay, go home, do your form 10 times. As you're doing your form, focus on your stance. Okay, great. Now they know I expect you to do it 10 times. And when you come back, I want your stance to look better than it did before, because I specifically want you to practice that one thing. So in these cases, when you don't necessarily get through everything you want, or want to get through, you can assign some homework and say, hey, we didn't get to this, but I want you to go home and practice that. When you come back, I'm going to look at it. That's the important thing too, is to inspect what you expect. So if you go and ask them to work on their form, and next class they come back, you don't even talk about, don't even do your form once, that's going to show them that, hey, he told me to practice my form, but he doesn't actually care if I do it or not. So when next time he gives me homework, I'm not going to do it because it's not important. So if you assign that homework, just like in school, grade that homework or check that homework. That way they know the importance and or how important it is that when you say something or you give them something to work on, they need to go work on that outside of the classroom.
Yeah, and you know, this is a good opportunity, if you haven't already done so, to set up some sort of online database of videos or documentation for how your moves are done. And then you can have the students go to that and reference that in class. Hey, listen, we worked on this today, but really we're a little behind. We should have gotten two more moves. And so I want you to go, we have an app. So I want you to go to our app and watch the video for this and see if you can pick up those next two moves. And I'm going to check in next class and see how well you did at that. So you give them the tools to help with this situation. You give it as a challenge almost to say, okay, here, I want you to see if you can do this. I know it's going to be tough, but I think I have faith that you guys are able to learn this and be able to do this no problem. So next class, when we get together, I'm going to check in and see how you guys did. And of course, you'll have, you know, maybe 50% that won't do it, and that's okay. The others that did do it will help the productivity of the class. It'll help move it along, because that's less time you have to spend on everybody relearning or reteaching those moves, because some of them already know it.
I think you might agree or disagree with me, but in those cases too, we rarely, the percentage of people who will go home and work on those things is unfortunately kind of low. So maybe you have 70% of the class who didn't go home and practice those things or didn't try to learn those extra few moves. Okay, you have 20% of the class. Well, I'll say 29% of the class who actually goes home and practices those things but can still use a little bit of work on it. And then you have 1% of that class who went home, worked on those things, has it very well, and even did a little bit of a dive in and knows more than you expected them to know. That very rarely happens, but it will happen. So again, I think when you even give those homework assignments, unfortunately, I would hate to say, and again, you might agree or disagree, but I almost expect them not to do it. I every class I say, hey, go home, practice this. I give them the specific homework details. But when I come back to class, I want to approach that class as if they didn't do it, because most of them probably won't do it. And if they did do it, they're going to be ahead, like you said. And if they went even farther, then they're going to be even more ahead, which isn't a bad thing, which is great. So unfortunately, even though we're trying to use this homework tool, it's not always received well or not always done. So don't rely on that as a crutch. Don't say, hey, go home and learn the next four moves. And they come back and then you take it from those next four moves and do the next four moves after that. You're going to have to spend some time on the four moves you asked them to practice, because chances are they didn't practice or they need a little bit extra work on those moves. So don't use that as your only method or the crutch that you rely on and try to get away or get out of teaching, because you still have to put the work in and do those things while they're there with you. That way they can go practice them or they know them up to your standards, and they're not going to be able to do it on their own in most cases. There are some kids, like I said, there's some students that will go home, do what you ask them to do, or even take it farther than you ask them to. But that's, in my experience, is very rare that happens.
Yeah, I would say that I would totally agree. The believing that the students who practice and actually go home and do the things that you ask them to do are the exception to the standard. Everybody else is going to take what you say and listen to you, likely or somewhat, while they're in class, go home and not think about karate until they come back the following time. And you have the exception to that, which is the handful of people across your whole student body that actually do the things that you want them to do. They go home and actually practice close to what you would like them to do. But just understand that's the exception to that rule. So if you have a lesson plan or class outline or some sort of game plan for the class, be sure to stick to that as closely as you can. And we talked about prioritizing the more important information. And this kind of goes with that, right? As you take a snapshot of your lesson plan, know what's on that lesson plan that's kind of extra credit or extra drill based, and what actually needs to get done in that class to be the bare minimum for the students to be moving forward. And when you have that, get those things out of the way first, right? For whatever reason, I found that when you have a large class or you're short-staffed, people like to make things up. And you know, they don't think they can actually get done what they think they need to get done for the day, so they just use it as a throwaway class, and they try all these cool, fun and exciting things, but they don't necessarily get anything actually accomplished for the class. So when you have a large class, it's not the time to go off script or try new and exciting things. You want to remember your students are going to be required to test over your information. So keep it relative to the information they need. Do at the very least the bare minimum to make sure they are improving in that class. And then once that stuff's out of the way, if you don't think that you have the staff or the ability to structure the other class or the rest of the class in such a way they can be productive, fine, okay, then you can throw some fun and exciting or you give them a good workout or whatever it is, but at the very least, get the bare minimum for that class in for that day and get the important stuff out of the way. The new information, prioritize that.
Yes, sir. Yeah, and I think as head instructor or someone in charge of other staff or junior staff members, I think it's important that we all sit down and identify the things that are a priority. So if they're in those situations and you have them trying to correct every little thing or go over everything they think they need to go over, tell them that, hey, listen, we want to focus on this first, then we focus on this, then we focus on this. That other stuff afterward is tertiary, it's extra. obviously we want them to do that and do that well, but we need them to do these three things specifically better or the best, and those need to be focused on the most. Those need to be prioritized, everything else. And then we prioritize those three main things, or however many things it is, we get them done, move on to the next thing, prioritize the next thing, and just have that list or that hierarchy and make sure everyone understands that. That way you're all not focusing on different things or prioritizing different things, and making sure you agree that these three things or however many it is need to be the priority. And we need to, again, work down that list of 1, 2, 3, 4, so on and so forth. And having everyone on the same page about that is crucial, because you and I, or you leading the class, can have a hierarchy or a priority list in your head. But if your junior staff members or the rest of your staff isn't in line with you, then it's gonna hurt your cohesiveness or hurt the delivery or emphasis on what's going on. So being on the same team and communicating, as we talked about before, is very, very important.
Absolutely. So do you have any closing remarks for teaching big classes, sir?
No, sir. I will say, after sitting here and talking about this, I want to go teach a big class. Like, I'm ramped up to be teaching a big class and utilizing these strategies. So hopefully that feeling transcends not only us right now in this room, but to everyone listening, and gives them some strategies or tactics they can try to implement if they haven't, or just reinforcement on those good ideas as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, teaching big classes can be tough and can be overwhelming. Just don't let that overflow, and don't let the students know it. Just keep your calm, cool, and collective. Prioritize the most important things and move on.
Yes, sir. Good luck with that, and hopefully some of these things work for you guys. You can find us on the socials, Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, YouTube, and Instagram. And we are also recording this podcast on video. Check us out in that video. See what we look like. See where we are. And we love to hear from you guys, as always. Comment, message us, tweet at us, all those kind of things. We love to the chance to grow and learn more together as a community, not just the two of us sitting across from each other.
Until next time, I'm Chris Bean.
And I'm Chris Kent.